Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's March 22nd, 2013. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Happy birthday, buddy.
Oh, thanks.
Do you finally look your age?
I've looked my age since I was 22. when I was 22, I looked my age that I am now.
That's what I mean. I'm wondering if you're ever going to catch up to your look is what I'm wondering. Will a number ever match the look, you know?
Okay, well, you know, I always take the proofs out to the poker room, the proof, you know?
Yeah.
And we just finished another fantastic issue. Did a wonderful job. The design was awesome, I think.
Oh, thank you.
Featuring our big Punta Cana event down in the Dominican. And so, you know, it's March down here in Florida, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of March in Florida, of course, you think of very young, hot people in bikinis first. and then second, third, fourth, and fifth. But sixth, you think of spring training, right?
Right.
You know, Major League Baseball players are down here. And, you know, I always take it for granted that we live down here and we can go to these games because I know so many people save up all year to travel down here.
Yeah.
To sit outside, getting sunburned, drinking $9 beers, watching a bunch of people that aren't going to make the team. but so I try to feel a need to kind of go out and catch a couple. And plus, I'm a baseball fan anyhow, right?
Yeah.
So this issue, I was like, you know what? Maybe I don't go to the track and play poker. Maybe I go to a spring training game and, you know, get one of those little berm seats, sit out there on the grass, and proof the pages there, and enjoy the nice weather we're having here, right?
Yeah.
So I thought about that, and got dressed, and got my baseball hat on, and then I'm like, you know what? This is kind of crazy. I'm not going to be able to concentrate on the proofs at a baseball game. But I'm playing poker, of course, because I don't pay attention to the poker at all. So, but baseball, I'm going to be paying attention, right? So, I mean, that's very irresponsible of me, right? So I'm like, all right. So I changed course, decided to go to the poker room, but still had my hat on, right?
Yeah.
And so I get to the poker room. It's the same one I go to all the time, you know, where all the dealers know me, the staff knows me, most of the players know me. Sit down, get in the tournament like always, play four or five hands, win a hand, dealer pushes me pot. Oh my gosh, Scott, I didn't recognize you there. I never see you with a hat on. And I'm like, Yeah, I know, I'm trying to be incognito. And then one of the players that knows me kind of laughed because I was wearing my Ante Up jacket with my name on it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I was really hiding. but three more dealers during that tournament did the same thing. I went five, six hands. They pushed me a pot. Oh, Scott, what are you doing? When did you buy a hat? So here's what I realized is, you know, I've always worried, you know, sometimes I'm going to get caught up in something. I might end up in the witness protection program. Well, because I watch a bunch of mob movies, right?
Not yeah.
Do anything.
Yeah.
And I would be really ticked because obviously, if I'm in the witness protection program, I'm not going to be able to play poker in a poker room, right? Because people are going to spot me, right? You know, yeah. the goons, God, that's coming after me, right? And now I am ecstatic because I know I will be able to play poker anywhere I want. I just have to wear a hat. It's an amazing disguise.
Well,
I didn't even need a mustache or glasses or anything. I just need a hat.
As I alluded to in the beginning of the show, you look a lot older than you actually are. I would venture to guess that it's because your hair was covered, not really the fact that it was a hat. So I would say that if you were in the witness protection, you could literally just get a dye job from L'Oreal and no one would know who you are.
A little of that Pete Rose Grecian formula?
Yes, exactly.
I didn't think about that, hiding my gray. So is that really it? You think people will recognize me for my grayness more?
Yeah, I think that, you know,
that's my signature look.
Emmett Smith's going to come at the door with a box of Just for Men and comb it out of your hair, and no one's going to know who the hell you are.
And what is Emmett Smith doing with that?
It's this gray beard. I don't
He's
know.
He's got no hair.
He's got a gray beard. Is the
you
beard
don't need
one.
A beard. You need hair.
She'll walk on his hands, then. Looks like he has hair on his head, then.
I'll tell you a couple people that probably wish they could be in the Witness Protection Program right now. It has not been a good week for world champions, has it not?
It has not been a good week, and it's like a dagger to the heart when you hear stuff like this.
Yeah, and really because it's two of what I consider the good guys in poker that get wrapped up. Obviously, right before last week's show, there was a report that Jerry Yang ran into some IRS troubles. We didn't bring it up on the show last week because it was just a report at that time, and we like to wait until it's official, and we'll talk about that a little bit later because it is now. But Jerry Yang's best friend right now has to be Greg Raymer, right?
Jeez.
Because a couple days after that, you know, I get back to the office after I was out running some errands, and things are blowing up here. I'm getting texts, I'm getting emails, I'm on Facebook, and all I see is Greg Raymer's mugshot. I can't imagine any of our listeners have not heard this already, but if not, he was arrested for soliciting a prostitute at a motel near his home in North Carolina. And certainly everybody is talking about this. So, I don't even know where to start on something like this. It's just tragic, isn't it?
It really hurts, you know. And here's the deal. People get arrested for doing this stuff all the time. You know, and it's not like he was running a prostitution ring or anything like that.
That we know of.
No. That we know, but I mean, just the fact that a world champion and someone, it's not even, not that I'm saying that there are world champion Deutsche Banks out there that I would expect this from, but what I'm saying is that when you think of Greg Raymer all this time, you've always thought of, this is the guy that just, you know, he does everything, you know, better than the next guy, you know what I mean? A patent lawyer, a world champion, a person who stands up for the little guy, and you know, in poker, you know what I mean? It was just to see that he had fallen from grace like this, just it really hurt. You know, we've had many conversations with Greg Raymer over the years, and it just hurt. It really hurt. I sat there and stared at his mugshot for like literally like 4 or 5 minutes, couldn't believe what I was seeing or reading. It felt exactly like, to me, not exactly, but it felt a lot like when they finally got Lance Armstrong, you know, only worse because it's something that I care about and play in and I've talked to the person, you know what I mean? It was worse than that, but that's the kind of impact this kind of thing has, you know? It's just absolutely just terrible that it happened. And I feel bad for his wife, too. His wife is getting a lot of the brunt of this too, and I just, for no reason, it's just absolutely,
you know,
terrible.
Yeah, and that's what's really angered me about this is, you know, like I said, I mean, half my Facebook feed is poker players, and half of those people were posting stuff that day, and just read through a couple of comments, and some of them just made my blood boil. I mean, say whatever you want about Greg. I mean, he made his bed here.
Yeah.
But you know, when they're attacking his wife and how his wife looks and stuff like that, that I just don't know whose parents raised him.
Yeah, exactly.
To go to that part. You know, it's just so infuriating to me, you know. I mean, you've got a guy that you could pick on all you want and deserves being picked on all you want, you know. You don't think this woman's suffering enough right now?
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, here, and I know a lot of our listeners are probably wondering why we're waxing on about this, because we always make a big deal about due process and waiting until convictions. But the one thing I will say, certainly not absolving Greg of anything he did, but I will give him credit for this. The very next day, or may even been that same day, his lawyer did issue a statement, and it said, "Mr. Raymer is very sorry for this lapse in judgment. He regrets deeply the pain he has caused his family, friends, and fans. Mr. Raymer is grateful for the many expressions of support he has received." So obviously, he's taking ownership of this problem.
Yeah.
Which, again, doesn't excuse what he did, but there are so many people I know that if they were to get caught in this situation would come out with guns blazing saying, "I was set up," or, "This is a huge mistake, I'm going to be exonerated," and then 6 months later they quietly are not exonerated.
Yeah.
And so I will give him credit for owning up to the issue and not hiding from it. Again, certainly not excusing the fact that he's doing it, but I got a couple other comments, but maybe let's talk about Jerry Yang first, because I think they're kind of combined here. If folks haven't heard of Jerry Yang, he has run into some serious IRS problems. He owes several hundred thousand dollars in back taxes. And a report that came out just before our last week's show said that the IRS will be seizing his bracelet and other mementos, and we'll be auctioning them to pay it off. Our good friends at Fifth Street Radio, including Mark Hoke, got the exclusive with Jerry and had him on the show last week. And very much like Raymer, he did come out and take responsibility. He said, you know, this is all on him. He did admit that he hired some people that he shouldn't have and took some advice he shouldn't have. And then, of course, the economy tanked at a bad time. But at the end, he says, you know, these are my problems. I need to own up to them. And right now they're negotiating with the IRS to hopefully at least hold on to his bracelet and come up with a payment plan. So we'll see where this goes. Obviously a different issue than Raymer, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Social moray kind of thing, right?
Sure.
But for me, what really kills me about this is, you know, I'm not bashful about saying this. I have been disappointed with the vast majority of professional poker players I've met. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been very excited to meet them. I finally meet them, and I just walk away just not having a good feeling from them, you mm-hmm. know, just not liking them for whatever reason, for different reasons for each of them. So there's a very small group of poker players that I think are classy people that I would recommend to poker rooms when they call me up and say, hey, we want to bring a pro in. Who would you suggest? A very small group right now. And that's not to say that the rest aren't. There's just, you know, there's people that I've known to be very reasonable in dealing with these appearances and being good stand-up guys that are going to represent and honor their contracts well. And Jerry and Greg were both on that list. And it's a double blow. I mean, I really think, you know, for both of these guys, it hurts the poker world. It hurts us. When we, you know, we just certainly don't wish getting arrested for solicitation or IRS problems on anyone. But there's certainly a lot of players that if it would happen, we'd be like, oh yeah, saw that coming.
Yeah.
And no big deal. You know, there's another brash, arrogant young kid that's going to come up next year, so who cares if we lose them? I don't want to lose these two guys. And, again, I think the problems with Greg are certainly far more serious than Jerry. But I guess my question to you is, will they be able to get back to that level that we held them to, and other people, I think, held them to?
Well, the thing that's so difficult about this is that we, I think, unfairly put them on a level because they won a poker tournament. And I know that Raymer, you know, we've spent a lot more time with Raymer than Yang. We spent some time with Yang. So we get to know these people, and when we do find someone that we feel is worthy of the title that we bestow upon them, then it hurts even more when something like this happens. Now, with that said, do I think that they can get back to what they once were? I don't know if they'll ever get to that level. I think Jerry Yang, he didn't pay his bill. That's nothing. If he figures out a way to pay his bill and, you know, whatever, he's still, yeah, I think that Jerry Yang has no problem achieving the level that he was at, because all he did was just not pay his bill because he hired the wrong person. You know, he made a mistake business-wise. If every person who made a mistake business-wise was cast out from their, you know, their level of popularity or fame or whatever, then, geez, look at Hollywood. America loves an underdog. So Jerry Yang, yeah, I don't think there's going to be any problem with him being able to show up at the Rio in the World Series one day and play again and, you know, not still want people to want to have their photo taken with him and get his autograph. And I think the same with Raymer. I think time heals all wounds. I think that he'll probably lay low for a while, get this out of his, you know, out of his way, and then eventually come back. I don't think that... I think it'll be difficult for people to maybe respect his point of view maybe down the road. Mm-hmm. Just because when I used to listen to Raymer, I thought, oh my God, this guy is just... he's just fantastic for poker. He's brilliant, and which he is. But then when he does something like this, yeah, okay, he's proving that he's human and that he's making mistakes like anybody else can make a mistake. I just don't know if the respect will be there for what he's saying, you know. And, of course, whatever he says now will be taken with a grain of salt, you know. And I think he will have to tone his way of presenting things to people if he does continue to be in the public eye. I don't know what he's going to do now. I don't know. You know, I'm sure he has enough money now that he could actually just be a recluse and never have to come out if he doesn't want to. But I don't think he's going to do that. I think that like you said, he's an upfront guy. He took responsibility for this, and that's really the best way to move on is to be forthright. But I don't think people will look at Raymer the same way at least for a long while. I think Yang, it's nothing really. I think it's an IRS problem. He's going to take care of it, and that's all there is to it. You know.
Yeah. Well, two things I'll say. One, you know, there is a difference between Raymer and Yang in general before this problem. And I'm not knocking Jerry Yang. He's a world champion. I never will be. But, you know, if you took a poll, I think it would be overwhelmingly that Greg Raymer is a more talented player. Am I wrong?
No.
And Raymer's obviously doing training with his Fossilman training. And, you know, he's kind of been the unofficial face of the Heartland Poker Tour. Certainly, you know, a big guy with stars. So, you know, I think it's a little bit more unfortunate. I mean, I think you're right that Jerry's going to be able to get through this pretty quickly. Unfortunately, it's not going to really help the poker world as much as if Greg could get through this much more quickly. You know, the other thing, too, I'll say is you're right. We do kind of put these people on a pedestal. But at the same time, you know, I do have a problem with this where people seek attention and then are not able or willing to recognize that they are now more responsible for their actions than they were before they sought attention.
Yeah.
And here's what I mean. You know, if you enter a poker tournament, you don't enter a poker tournament without designs on winning it, right?
Right.
And certainly not the World Series. You want to be the world champion. You want to be the one that's holding up that bracelet, having that big wad of cash, and then all the fame and fortune that comes from it. What you don't, I don't think some of these people realize, and I'm sure, I know Greg did, but I don't think most of these people realize, is once you get that now, that's a burden. You know, now you're representing poker whether you want to or not, and you have to hold yourself to a higher standard, because if you fall down, it's not just you, it's, you know, poker that's taking a hit because of this. Mark Hoke on Fifth Street Raider made a really good point last night. He ran through the last, I don't know, dozen or so world champions, and with only a couple exceptions, every one of them had some kind of skeleton, either before they won the title or after the title. And he was wondering, you know, hey, are we just continuing this with these two problems this week, continuing this public persona of poker players being less than stellar people, and maybe it's going so far as being seedy people? It's not helping our reputation, is it?
No. No, you're right. And as you think about the list, I agree with him 100%. There are pretty much skeletons in most of these people's closets that we, and in the ones that we don't, who knows? It still could be, and we don't even know it, or something could happen. So you're right. I hate to think that if I enter a tournament and win it, I'm entering it knowing that I could have this huge burden put on me. I mean, can't a person play a tournament and just play it for the money? You know, it stinks that you have to now, because it's become this popular thing.
Don't think you can.
You could have before 2003, you know. I think you could have in 2003, so it's not...
But it's different.
You know. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think a lot of people... Some people may enter the tournament thinking they're not going to win. They just want to play it, and then end up winning it, and they're screwed.
But once you win, I mean, I think here's what's got to go through your mind. Once you become the world champion, you get on TV, and you start getting endorsements, you got to say, you know what? I guess I got to quit hiring hookers.
Yeah.
You know, and again, I'm not trying to pile on Greg here, but it comes with the territory, you know? You know, you're Barack Obama. You can't go on a bender, you know, getting ripped at the casino and blowing your White House credit card on blackjack. There's just things you can't do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and just picking that example out. But, I mean, it's what comes with it. And, you know, but at the same time, you're getting compensated well for that change in lifestyle. You know, you're making... $7-10 million on that tournament, plus all these endorsements. So, you know, you got to give what you get on it, I think. You know.
I don't think
anybody listening to us right now would not want to be the world champion and have that fame and fortune. But I think if everybody that's listening was honest with themselves, they probably likes, to some extent, the obscurity of their life right now.
Yeah. No, it's definitely difficult to deal with. I remember when even before we left the Times and our show was only, you know, in its infancy, you know, people were making comments on our blog about personal things about us, you know, and I was just like, are you kidding me? You don't even know us. So how do you talk, you know? And then they're like, well, you're in the public eye now, and, you know, we can do whatever we want. And it's true.
Right. I mean, we talked about that on the show. I mean, we can't say to poker players what we sometimes want to say to them.
Right.
Because we're representing Annie Up now. I mean, that's a sacrifice that I am willing to make for doing what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
and probably some other people in my position would not be willing to make that sacrifice and probably are not going to be as successful as I hope we eventually are because of it. But yeah, there's times there's just some Deutsche Bank at the table I just want to rip a new one, but I can't. And it's just the way it is. So, and certainly not going to be hiring hookers, not that I ever wanted to before, but you know, it's just stuff, you know.
It does raise other questions too, like was this a you know, thing that he always did? Was it the first time he got caught? Was it the first time he did it and got caught? You know, was he habitual, you know, John? Those are things that I wonder, will they come out or not? Or was it the first time he ever did it? You know, he's having trouble at home and whatever. You just don't know what they're, you know. And I always like to believe the good in people. I always do. That's why I just denied Lance Armstrong for so long. Yeah. And then it was just like, what am I doing sticking up for this guy that I don't even know? And it's so obvious that he's doing all these things. So, but I like to believe, I've met Raymer. I've talked to Raymer. And I know he had this, you know, he had this sort of air about him, you know, that, you know, he was very smart and very, you know, whatever. And now, but now I just, you know, I'd like to know. I feel bad. I'd like to think that he just slipped once, you know, and it wasn't this habitual thing and it wasn't. Yeah. But I don't know if we'll ever find that out either.
No, we'll see. Yeah. Maybe.
All right. Well, we do have a hotline and change the tone of the show a little bit. 813-448-1120. You call it, we use it. We'll give you something cool. This is Nick.
Hello. This is Nick Corin, longtime listener to Andy Up podcast. And I wanted to reach out and wish Scott Long a very, very happy birthday. So, Scott, I hope you have a great day on Friday. We'll be thinking of you. Thank you for all you and Chris do, and keep doing it, guys. You're having some great success, and the Annie Up Nation's behind you. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Aw, oh, Nick. Thanks, bud.
I
even
Nick
called in a couple days ago, so he must have my birthday on his calendar even.
Wow, he must have it circled with a heart or something.
I don't even have my birthday on my calendar. I mean, this is an absolute true story. I was out to dinner with my parents last week. As we always do, we go out once a week. And they're like, all right, well, we'll see you next week. Pick someplace nice to go for your birthday. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. It is my birthday next week. I just don't get worked up about it. But I certainly do appreciate when other people get worked up about it. So thanks, Nick. You're my hero.
Man, like Scott says, not big enough for that hat that he wears to conceal himself at the poker room. Now you got people calling and wishing him happy birthday.
Well, yo, here's the thing. I give Nick a tremendous amount of credit. All right? He's got to be a very strategic player. I don't want to play poker with Nick because here's what I know, whether he did this or not, I'm going to give him credit for it. He sat back and go, you know what? I'm going to mark Scott's birthday on my calendar. I'm going to call several days ahead, blowing his mind, which he did, knowing that I'm going to be the first one to call the hotline to wish him a happy birthday, and I'm going to get swag for doing it.
Yep, pretty smart.
He's smart. So yes, Nick, I appreciate the happy birthday wish, and we're going to give you our new item on our swag shelf, the Pot Odds Made Simple Seminar from poker extractor Thomas Gallagher, which can be downloaded at any mobile device. Folks can get your own by mentioning Ante Up at www.poker911.net. Sounds like we might even need to get that seminar, Chris.
Definitely. Hey, we have a mailbag from someone named Turdzilla, and I want you to understand that this isn't the only Turdzilla I know. So, I know plenty of Turdzillas.
Well, what's funny about this is this is the Turdzilla that is a longtime listener. But when he emailed it to us, he spelled his name Tudzilla.
Yeah, I saw that Tudzilla.
And I'm like, I thought in my mind, I'm like, you know what? We give him so much crap on the show about his name in the past that maybe he got illegally changed. Maybe went down to the courthouse and said, you know what, I can't handle it anymore.
I need to be Tudzilla.
Yeah, so when I wrote it back, I'm like, hey, Tud. And he wrote back, oh, man, I'm sorry I misspelled my name. It should be Turd. I'm like, shoot, you ruined my whole story.
See, that's how you realize it's not his real name, because he wouldn't misspell his own real name. He's not doing like Scott Lang. You know, he's Turdzilla. So anyway, he wants to know what a bad beat is. Is it based on the odds of losing the hand on the flop, turn, river, the size of the pot, your mental makeup and propensity to go on tilt? Should you be pissed or amused when you are bad beaten? Should you buy back in immediately or take a break and leave? Should you say anything? should you buy the Beat E a beer? Is he really serious, or is he just having fun with us?
No, I think he's trying to get at the psyche of the bad beat here. I mean, obviously, I think he knows what a bad beat is, but I think he's trying to wonder how we are all describing it. And I will say yes to all of his questions, especially the last one. I'm all a big fan of getting beers when I bad beat someone.
So wait a minute. So yes, he should buy back immediately, and yes, he should take a break, and yes, he should leave? How can he do all that at once?
He needs to have a split personality. That's the only way to get through this.
I get it.
But no, I guess what I meant by that is, I think this is different for everyone. It's just your makeup and what you think. I mean, obviously, I think from a successful poker player standpoint, being able to handle bad beats in the best way possible is going to be very good for your game.
Mm.
You know, if you need to learn how to deal with you, I think one, you need to learn that they're going to happen, that they're not really truly bad beats. It's just variance catching up to you, as we like to say, and you're going to need to find a way to let it roll. Now, obviously, some are worse than others. You know, let's say you're second in chips at the World Series of Poker main event, that you never buy it into a tournament for more than $40 ever. And you are one away from the November 9, and you get it all in with aces against someone with Jack Deuce, and they flop three deuces, and you're out. That's going to be a lot harder to come back from than, you know, getting sucked out in the 2-4 limit game on the end. But at the same time, I think it's just all how you deal with it. And I think it's a perception thing. I mean, obviously, I think the answer to that first question that I'm saying, how you deal with bad beats, helps answer the rest of these questions. I mean, for example, we're not going to go through all these, I don't think, but, you know, he's talking about the odds of losing a hand on the flop, turn, river. I mean, that's different for everyone else, you know? I mean, I've seen some people that have flopped bottom two pair and have flipped the chair over, running away from the table when someone catches a set on the river.
Mm.
To my mind, that is not a bad beat. Come on, dude. There is going to be a lot worse things that are going to happen to you. But in that person's mind, that's what he thinks is a bad beat. So, you know, it really does just depend on how you bounce back, how bad the beat is, and what you think a bad beat is.
Yeah, I mean, the part about the variance is what people, a lot of people will come back with. They'll say that it's more, instead of a bad beat, call it bad timing. You know, out of the, when you're favored to win 81% of the time with your aces and you lose, it's bad timing. That is the time that you didn't win with them. It's bad variance for you. But, and you're right, to me, a bad beat is just when you're overwhelmingly favored to win the hand and don't. That's a bad beat. Now, how you react to it, like you said, it's all relative. Is it a, you know, or do you have 5 million chips in a tournament against somebody who has 100,000 and you just lost 100,000 to your 5 million? You know, yeah, it's a bad beat, but it's not a bad beat emotionally because you just get him on the next hand or next hand or next hand, next hand, next hand because you got him out chip 5 million to 1, so, or whatever the hell it is. So,
yeah,
it's all relative. It's all relative. But I mean, you know, statistically, it's just when you're an overwhelming favorite to me on the end or a preflop and you lose. That's sort of a bad beat. You're right, though. I think you're right. It just depends on who you are and the circumstances and how you. You know, do you buy somebody a beer after they took all your money? I don't think I'm doing that, no matter how nice of a guy I am.
Yeah, that might push me to my limit. I would gladly accept one if I'm bad beaten.
Yeah, bad beaten. Beaten badly.
In fact, actually, depending on how bad you beat me, I might ask for a bucket of beer.
Yeah.
But I will say this. I mean, the one thing that really rubs salt in the wound, and I'm trying not to do it now because by nature I'm a nice guy, you know, good old Midwestern, raised by my mom to treat people with respect.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I do put a bad beat on someone, I feel the need to apologize or at least make reference to the fact that I realized that I got super incredibly lucky or variance caught up to me at the right time, whatever you want to say, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I've learned that in that situation, most people can't handle that comment. And I am now trying really hard now to just quietly stack my chips, not gloat, not do anything, just be a stoic like a statue in a rock garden until the player calms down or move on or something like that.
Yeah.
Because I've seen this too many times. Oh man, I'm sorry, that sucks. Don't apologize to me. And I get it now. Sometimes people just don't want, because they don't think it's sincere, even if when it is sincere. So,
Sorry, man. You don't mean it. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's like.
Yeah, well, God. Technically, you don't. You're right, yeah. But, I'm trying to help you out, dude.
I mean, I'm glad I'm still alive in the tournament, and you're right. I'm not sorry, but I'm sorry that I. No, you're not. Yeah, you're right. All right, let's just keep playing.
But that'd be my parting advice to folks is lose the apology and lose the gloating if you do.
Either. Yeah, yeah, don't gloat.
Yeah.
Good God. You were the idiot getting it in behind. Are you gloating?
But there are probably more people that gloat than apologize.
Yeah, which is sad.
You have people that jump up and slam, that's what I'm talking about. Well, you haven't been talking about anything. Where does that saying come from? Running around high-fiving people, even people they don't know, just... Sit your ass down.
Who raised these people?
Yeah.
We've never heard that before.
I'm telling you.
I've heard that before somewhere. I don't know where.
All right, Turdzilla. It's been quite a while since we've heard from you. Actually, it hasn't been. But it's been long enough that you get some swag, and we're going to send you a lovely deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. Pick up your own decks in the Anti-Up store at antiupmagazine.com/shop. And I do believe we forgot to mention the hotline number, because you could also win swag if you do that. That's 813-448-1120.
I said the hotline number. You calling me out in front of the Anti-Up Nation?
I always like to repeat it, though.
Oh, I think I did. Now you got me second-guessing myself.
Yeah, well, you don't remember a lot of stuff anymore, so...
Well, speaking of Call the Floor is an audio call. Somebody called our hotline for the Call the Floor. Let's listen in.
Hi, Scott and Chris. This is Greg from California. And I've got a question for you guys. I just played in a tournament, and the final board was 6-6-6-3-3, and it was checked around to me, and I had jack-6, so obviously the nuts. And I went all in, and then the guy next to act said, I'm all in, huh? And didn't put out his money, and the play proceeded. The next guy also went all in, and I won the hand. But the guy who said, I'm all in, huh, did not want to pay, saying that he did not put out the bet, but I disagree. So I'm just calling to see what you guys' opinions are. Thank you.
All right, this is what Jody says. He says, I'm not sure about this one. I need more info. I really need to know how much each player had in front of them, if this was a cash game or tournament, and how long of a pause occurred between the middle player's comment and the last player's all in. Based on what I'm hearing, it seems to me you declared all in, the next player was simply repeating what you said, and the last player acted too fast. I don't think the middle player was given enough space to act here. The dealer should have verified the middle player was actually all in before allowing a showdown.
I agree with that.
Yeah, that's kind of the sense I got to. Again, I think with Jody, this would be one of those where you wish it wasn't an audio call for, but a video.
Video, yeah, you can see
it. Actually, rewind it and see it. Then that would become a lot more clear. But based on what we're hearing, it did. I mean, I get that. I always think of in these situations, because this comes up in poker all the time. I think of my cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
You know that scene where I shot the clerk? I shot the clerk? And you think about it, in the transcript, it sounds like exactly how the joke they were getting there. I shot the sheriff. Yeah. And the sheriff reads it back. Or I shot the clerk. And that's the same thing. All in. And I find myself doing that at the table sometimes when I'm trying to clarify if the action was all in. And I'm saying all in. And I can understand, and I know, I mean, I've been lucky that I haven't got called on that yet. But I would understand if someone said, committed me to that. And I think you've got to be cognizant of not doing that.
Yeah.
You need to be more clear.
Exactly.
Is the bet? Is the bet all in? And that's a little different than all in. Or this, probably would happen here, the all in, eh? Kind of thing where you're reflective and pensive.
Yeah, because call the floor, floor comes over. Mr. Long, did you say all in? Well, yeah, I said all in, but I said all in.
That's not what I meant.
That's not what I meant. And they're like, sorry, you're all in. I'm like, but I said all in with a question mark on the end. Well, I'm sorry, that's not what it sounded like to us. So you're all in. Then you're screwed. So gotta be careful.
Words have meanings.
Damn it. All right,
Greg, we appreciate you calling our call the floor this week. And remind everybody else to email your call the floors to podcast@antiupmagazine.com or call us on the hotline Once again, that number, since we haven't given it to you yet, the show, 813-448-1120. We use it on the show. We're going to give you something great, like we're going to give Greg a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store.
Do you think any professional poker dealers listen to our show?
We will find out after this next...
Maybe our listeners have friends who are professional poker dealers, and they can pass this on. Because I don't think dealers listen to us. I think that, you know, they think we're crazy.
Well, I know they used to a long time ago.
Yeah, we must have offended them, though, I think.
So. I do. I mean, we actually did have somebody said, you know, I've known a couple of dealers. They're not big fans of Andy Up because you guys got on the show and tell people not to tip them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa, what?
We never did that.
Never did that. Oh, that's what they said. And I'm like, well, tell them to relist because I think they missed a couple words.
Yeah.
Or a dozen words.
Well, if you are a professional poker dealer or you know someone who is that wants to be considered for spots on our Andy Up cruises, Andy Up poker tour events, or other Andy Up events, you can now apply at AndyUpMagazine.com/dealers, and we'll keep that on file and consider you down the road. Pretty cool stuff.
Absolutely. Our new Andy Up store is open. We've expanded the number of Andy Up logo items available for sale, including jackets, shirts, hats, and more. I just sent a bunch of stuff out to Hawaii.
Cool.
So if you're in Hawaii, look for the guy wearing the Andy Up hat and t-shirt. We've also consolidated all of our shopping items, subscriptions, single copies, cruises, and products from our trusted partners into one great website at AndyUpMagazine.com/shop.
Hey, got some great Andy Up Poker Tour events coming up real soon. Running Aces Harness Park near Minneapolis will host the Andy Up Midwest Championship and Andy Up Poker Tour Series April 11th to the 21st. And our good friends from Fifth Street Radio will be broadcasting live from the main event. More information can be found at AndyUpMagazine.com/runningaces. But also, Downstream Casino Resort will host its Four States Poker Championship Andy Up Poker Tour event May 17th to the 26th. And has posted its schedule at AndyUpMagazine.com/downstream. More details on all AUPT events can be found at AndyUpPokerTour.com.
And, of course, the Hard Rock Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic is now accepting bookings for the Andy Up Poker Tour World Championship event July 28th to August 3rd. The luxurious all-inclusive resort, 14 tournaments with buy-ins as low as 115 buckaroos, with the winner of the $1,100 main event appearing on the cover of Andy Up Magazine. More information can be found at AndyUpMagazine.com/world championship, including how you can win your way there at Dover Downs in Delaware, Thunder Valley in California, Sarasota Kennel Club in Florida, Cypress Bayou in Louisiana, and Running Aces in Minnesota, with more to be added soon.
Finally, Walt Strakowski is our 2010 Player of the Year and a single table specialist. He's going to be the pro on our May 20th AndyUp Poker Cruise out of Miami, which will spotlight Sit and Goes. Rates are no longer guaranteed, but call us as soon as you can so we can get you the best rate possible before our ship sells out. We're also sailing out of New York, Tampa. Get all the details, including how you can win your way on board at Dover Downs in Delaware and Naples Fort Myers Ground Track in Florida at AndyUpCruises.com. And just announced, this is very exciting, Palm Beach Kennel Club in Florida is going to be giving away 30 cruise packages in 30 days. The high hand between 4 and 6 p.m. every day in April will win a cruise package.
That is the best promotion any poker room
has. That's awesome.
Isn't it? Every day in a month, you can win a cruise.
That is so cool. Every time you show up, you know you can win a cruise. That's pretty awesome. All right, what's going on with the Andy Up News Desk this week?
A joint committee of Louisiana legislators will study the benefits and drawbacks of online poker with a mandate to report back their findings before the 2014 session of the legislature begins.
Another state. I'm telling you, it's going to happen. Yeah.
Baby steps, doing
Baby
a study.
Steps. It's all going to keep going forward. We'll have to see how that one plays out, but still some time left, so.
Plenty of time.
NetTeller, the payment processor of choice for most U.S. poker players before the UIGEA was passed and the company's founders were arrested and player funds frozen, is preparing to re-enter the U.S. market. NetTeller's parent company has reached a deal with Caesars Interactive Entertainment, and its CEO says he doesn't anticipate many hurdles with regulators.
Regulators. I'm wondering how frosty the reaction to players is going to be.
Yeah.
I didn't have any money on NetTeller, and so I still have a very positive opinion of them because they were awesome, you know, when they were working. You know, you just went on there, boom.
Right.
Upload a check, boom, got your money. It was super sweet. But I am not one of the people that had their money frozen for a while. So that's going to be a next step, you know, if, poker players have long memories, as we talked about at the top of the show.
But it was frozen because of the government, right? Not because they did anything wrong, right?
Well, yeah.
Essentially.
Again, it's kind of government saying that they were being illegal rather than many of us believing they were illegal. Right. So, yeah. But you know, again, I don't know whether people make that distinction. I hope they do. Hope they do, but sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
And finally, the USS Iowa has received a reproduction of a poker table used by President Harry Truman, which was built by Iowa Craftsman. The original is on display at Truman's vacation home in Key West, Florida.
Wow.
I think we can get a tour of the USS Iowa.
I think so.
I looked at it. It's a pretty cool table. It's one of those round ones, you know, kind of those old school round ones.
Yeah.
With a little chip racks built in.
Yeah.
With like individual chip racks, you know, yeah. So you put all your like white chips in one, and so it's for very organized poker players, you know.
Cool.
But it's only six handed, right? So, you know, you're not going to get the big no limit game going on. I'm guessing they probably played a lot of stud back in Truman's days, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The buck stops here.
It's kind of like that old. Judges kind of game, kind of table, I think. Yeah.
Except Matt Damon's not coming in and telling them.
Yeah, exactly.
How to play their hands. All right, we got a brand new O'Malley's move. He's about to give birth. It's crowning. Let's hear part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're seated at a $1, $2 PLO 8 game. This table is loose and can get a bit on the aggressive side. We sit with $300, down 50, but with an average stack. The under the gun calls, the MP calls, and we're in the cutoff at this six-handed table with the King of Clubs, King of Diamonds, 5 of Spades, 4 of Clubs. We've got no nut draws either way, and perhaps the pair of kings suckers us into making this call, but we do. The button folds, some good news, the small blind folds, and the big blind checks. With $9 in the pot, we see a flop of the Jack of Diamonds, 3 of Hearts, Deuce of Clubs. Not the flop we were looking for, but really then, what were we looking for? The big blind leads out for $5. The under the gun folds, but the MP calls. Interestingly enough, both these players are new to PLO 8 and have a tendency to play way too many hands. We've got both of them covered. Unfortunately, we don't quite know their range in this situation, so we call. With $24 in the pot, the turn is the 10 of clubs. The big blind pots it, and the MP calls. What do we do?
Druko, and a loyal listener who joined us on our most recent poker cruise, suggested we do a show dedicated to quote-unquote new poker terminology, which some listeners might not understand, or frankly, just doesn't make sense. We asked you to send in some examples, and Drew was the first one to email us with a gaggle of great terms to discuss. He also mentioned two websites that have helped him with definitions, which my good friend Chris here will put on our show cap at antiupmagazine.com/4. But we're going to run through this list and a couple that our good friend, some other folks sent in, and just do our best to kind of bring you up to the futuristic lingo speak. But first I'm going to say, when we were going through this list last night, I was thinking, there's nothing else I do in my life that has this much lingo.
Mm.
You know, I mean, not that I have a tremendous bevy of other hobbies, you know, travel, beer drinking, watching sports. That's about it.
Fantasy sports. They have any lingo in that?
Well, yeah.
They do?
But again, I don't know of this many lingo. The lingo is just so thick in poker compared to others.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just because I was working on this list last night. But that was my impression. I'm like, wow. You know, Drew's right. Some of this stuff is just crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And that's what happens when you get a bunch of brainiacs together and do something. You know what I mean? Most people who play poker are brilliant, you know? And they come up with all these new ways to talk about things, you know. It's pretty wild. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to go through the list, and, you know, some of these you may say, oh, that's not new. But it may be new to other people. We got to remember, we got a huge audience. It's not just those who are, you know, studying poker every day of their lives. So some of these terms you may already know. Some you may not. Some you may never have heard of. Some we don't even know, and that's half the fun. It's the charm of the show is we may just...
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say when I went through, there were at least a couple that I just stone cold did not know. and a couple other that I was fuzzy enough on that I had to look up to be sure or ask you. So certainly if as we go through this list, some of them you're like, yeah, you know, I've always been wondering about that, but I've been embarrassed to ask. Take some solace in knowing that we don't know some of these things.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Not the only one.
And you may find out after this is all done that we still don't know what we're talking about.
Quite certainly.
And I'm sure we'll get 1,000 emails about it. So the first one, which obviously isn't really new, I think, but a lot of people don't understand exactly what they mean when they say jam.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that jam generally means raise all in. You know, people jam the pot, you know. But as listener David Bloomberg said in Phil Hellmuth's Play Poker Like the Pros, which I still to this day say wasn't as bad as everyone made it sound. They just like to pick on Phil Hellmuth. But he used the term jam to simply mean raise, because he uses the term in discussing various limit games. And that's true. I remember him saying, if you're dealt like ace, deuce, tray, jam the pot in Raz. I remember that specifically, him saying you want to jam it. So that's true.
But, you know, I haven't read it, but I'm guessing it probably still does have a different connotation for him than just raise. I imagine he's probably, and again, correct me based on your understanding, I think what he's probably trying to say rather than raise there is that this is a hand that he's going to raise, re-raise, whatever. He's going to get as much money in the pot as he possibly can.
Yes.
Obviously, it's a limit game, so you can't do that. But it's you know, I'm going to raise, and if somebody re-raises me, I'm absolutely going to raise again.
Yes, exactly. Jam
versus
as much money
raise.
In there as you can. Get it in there as much as you can. And some of the things, too, about the terms, is not just the definition of them, but maybe how it got to that point. Like, jam is another way to shove. You shove something into a hole, you jam it into a hole, you know, whatever it is, you jam it, you shove
it. I think
it
would be awesome. Instead of raising all in, I just slather my opponent with strawberries.
Damn. Oh, man. So, but yeah, that's essentially what it means. It's just get it all in or get as much money in as you possibly can at any moment with the hand you have. So,
all right, next one was Knit and Nitty. That is easy. Scott Long.
Yeah, Scott Long. Somebody who's
very
tight.
If you like me, you are Knit and Nitty. But no, it means tight, which is funny. I was writing this last night. I'm like, I said same as tight. And then I'm like,
wait,
you know what?
Now, what's tight?
Now I'm going to have to explain what tight means, right? This is why this is so hard. I get it. So, you know, the best way I could describe, and I'm sure you could probably describe it better, is just a player who doesn't give much action, is, you know, plays premium hands, doesn't get too crazy at the table. I don't know. I mean, it's tough to describe tight, right? Other than just saying tight, you know.
Yeah, I think it translates to when you're talking to a poker player, they'll translate it to all walks of life. You know, as far as you know,
do you
want to gamble on the Notre Dame game? No, I don't gamble. You're a nit. You know, it could be just anybody who doesn't want to part with money. Anybody who's really tight with their money. So, you know, that comes from tightwad. When you're a tightwad, when somebody says somebody's tight. You know, a tightwad is somebody doesn't want to spend any money, doesn't want to spend their money on anything. So, yeah, nitty, he's nitty. It's just another beautiful way of making it an adjective, I guess. I don't know. The next one is opening wide. And then we have in parentheses here range. A player who doesn't need premium cards to be the first one to enter a pot, and generally for a raise, I would think, not just to come in, not just to limp, but to actually raise.
Right,
is
right.
When you open. When you're opening a bet, you're the one who's changing the bet from what it is. So if somebody's a small and big blind and you're first to act and you raise, you have now opened. And if you've done it with hands that are less than premium, like aces, kings, or queens, and ace-king, and things like that, like if you've done it with 7-8 suited, then that's opening wide.
Yeah, and he asked, again, this is kind of the second part of this whole show is... Well, he's like, there's no narrow, not opening narrow. And, you know, I guess what I say to that is, you know, it's just the action of opening wide is out of the norm.
Yeah.
Although it's becoming less out of the norm now, I think, probably.
All right.
But, so, I mean, to say opening narrow is almost redundant. Just say open, you know. It's the wide that makes a difference.
Right, exactly. It's exactly right. Because if you're opening legitimately, or, you know, ABC-wise, then... It's obviously a narrow range because the only hands that you open with are narrow already. So, very good point.
And very similar to the next term, value betting thin. And he says, no fat or thick. Plenty. I got plenty of fat here, although I'm trying to lose
it. He's losing it. He's losing it.
but I would call this a smallish bet. Again, a value bet is a smallish bet to attract an extra bet out of your opponents when you believe you have the best hand. So, doing it thin would be... with a hand that's not necessarily a monster. I mean, I guess I'm thinking of it as if you've got quads, that's you at this point you're just trying to get anything you can out of your opponents with that hand. But value betting is, you know what, I've got a straight, but I'm not really confident that it's really great, but it's still I think I have the best hand. I'm gonna say that's what I think value betting is.
Yeah, when you have like the ignorant end of a straight and somebody could easily have like the jack in their hand to have a bigger straight, or
there you go.
Yeah, you know, you have two pair, but easily somebody could have a flush or a full house because of the way the hand came down or something, and you still put a bet in first, then you have a really thin holding, a hand that's not very strong, and you're still trying to get a bet out of somebody. So I think that's what that is, value betting thin, because you're pretty confident you still have the best hand, but you don't have near the nuts. That's how I pictured it too.
And generally speaking, you are value betting thick, so that's or fat. That's,
fat. That's this next one is interesting. ICM aware. That's letters I, C, M as in Michael, aware. This one refers to the independent chip model, hence the acronym. And so it would mean the player is fully versed in what ICM is, or you are, and you should make that part of your decision making. ICM refers to the player's overall equity in a tournament. Utilizing the chip stacks and the likelihood of where someone would finish in a tournament and where that stack would finish in a tournament and everything like that. So if somebody is that well-versed and using that for their approach to the tournament or what they're going to do on the hand or whatever, then you can consider that person ICM aware, or you would be ICM aware if you knew all that stuff too. You know, I just Google it. That's because there's so much out there about it, about ICM and specifically. So.
Yeah, and we've had a request to do an entire show on ICM. Obviously, that's not something that we're going to do. But no. Maybe we get somebody that's a little bit more versed in it to come on here and explain that. But yeah, that's a whole book there, let alone a term. Our next is a 3-bet bluff, 3-bet jam, 3-bet light, though no 3-bet heavy. So in general, 3-bet means you're the second raise or the third action, bet, raise, and then your raise. If you're doing with a junk hand, obviously it's a bluff. We all know what a bluff means, I hope. And if your raise is all in, it's a jam, which we already defined, right?
Right.
And if it's not a premium hand, but better than junk, it's light. And again, heavy is assumed. You know, if you're 3-betting, you're assumed to have a strong hand. So if you're doing it with complete air.
Yeah, and it could be when these are happening, too. Like, I wouldn't think about 3-betting light as often after the flop as I would before the flop.
Mm-hmm.
I think that 3-bet light in conversations come up a lot more when there's a bet and a raise and you realize that these guys aren't that strong and they're loose players and that they'll probably fold to another bet, so you don't, doesn't matter what you have in your hand, so you 3-bet light. That's a lot of times that comes up in a conversation, whereas very rarely does somebody say, I 3-bet them light on the river. That kind of thing doesn't always come up in conversation. So it tends to come up pre-flop more than any other situation in a flop game. So,
and you know what I'll say about a lot of these terms too, is that the terminology, I think, comes more often in the post-hand analysis.
Sure.
You know, where people are describing a situation, so they've come up with these ways for shorthand to describe it to people. So, you know, I think if people were out there thinking, I need to be aware of these terms in the middle of a hand, and should I be aware I'm 3-betting light? I think that's an example of something that I don't think you're supposed to be aware of. It's just after the hand's out and you realize that your hand is not as good as you thought it was or something like that, then when you're describing it to someone, then it helps to say, you know, he 3-bet light rather than going through the whole paragraph.
Exactly. If you had to say he 3-bet me with a really junk hand, he had 7-deuce off suit. Okay, well, you could just say light, and you could have summed that up in a second.
Can we find a quicker term?
to describe my bad beat. okay, a 2 or 3-barrel bet, 2 or 3-barrel bluff. This is betting the flop, and then the turn, and then the river. And like a bullet, hence the barrel, like the barrel of a gun, you have nothing. It's strictly a bluff. You always hear that Stu Unger was very famous for 3-barreling a bluff, because it's very difficult to keep betting when somebody keeps calling, because if they keep calling, it's not that they have something. So to bet that third time in a row is very difficult. So a three-barrel bluff or a three-barrel bet is very difficult to pull off when somebody's calling you down.
That's a very good description of it, is the, you know, betting and getting called, but then still firing and being undeterred. That's probably a really good way of describing it. Good job.
Yeah, he was real famous for that, too. He was real famous for having the...
Oh, because he was super aggro,
which we'll talk about soon, yeah.
all right, repot, reshove, and rebluff, and he wants to know, did I make that last one up? This one seems fairly easy to me. Simply just repeating the action of the previous player. You know, if that previous player bet pot and then you bet pot again, you repotted it.
Right.
If he shoved and now you're shoving too, you reshoved. And yes, I'm pretty sure he made up the last one.
Actually, I've heard people say that.
Rebluff?
I didn't think he made it up. Rebluff, yeah.
Okay.
It's a matter of fact, I think it was Sean Deeb who told us that. It was either when we were up in Jacksonville or whatever.
Rebluff, it would be Sean D.
Yeah, he was like, I knew that Tyler, remember Tyler? He said,
Smith,
right? Yeah, Tyler Smith. He's like, I knew he was bluffing, so I rebluffed. And because, you know, a bluff doesn't necessarily have to be an all-in bluff. People think bluffs are always tied to all-ins, and they're not.
Yeah.
And the shove, a reshove, could mean because you're trying to, you know, you're trying to isolate somebody who already shoved, or you have somebody behind you, and so you want to make more money, so you shove after his shove. So, very simple stuff. This one, it's not a new term at all. Just someone asked about open raising. It's the act of raising when you're the first one to act. That's all it is, really. Just open raise. You raise the first time action gets to you and no one else is raised, so you raise first.
Yeah, again, so it's just like raising, except the extra description is that you're the first one.
You're the first one that raised in the hand.
Same with flatting. Again, a term that most people are using now, but again, doesn't make much sense because it's just calling. But again, it's used in the post-hand analysis, I think, to describe that, you know, you have a hand that you could raise with, but at that point you decline to do so, you just decline to call.
Exactly.
So again, during the middle of the hand, in your mind, you might be trying to flat in your mind, but it's not really an issue in the hand. It's afterwards when you realize that, you know, hey, I had aces there, I thought about raising, but I was just going to flat them.
I think we talk about that a lot in the show, or I bring it up a lot when they say that in description of the hand of the week. He's like, so they just flat called me. And I'm like, all right, well, you just gave away the whole hand. How do you know he flat called unless he knew he had a good hand? And, you know, so you've already told me this guy has a great hand, so it's easy for me to deduce that, you know, you're going to lose his hand. So don't say flat call if you want somebody to try to figure out what happens at the end, because you know they got a good hand.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
Keep the terminology to a minimum. To keep our enjoyment to the maximum.
This next one looks like we could literally dedicate a whole show to it, but upper slash lower parts of opponent's range slash squeeze range slash range balancing slash calling range. okay, well, we should probably just define what range is first. An opponent's range is basically the spectrum of hands you believe they might have based on what their action is. So upper is the best hands in that range, and lower are the worst hands, or the inferior hands.
Right.
In someone's range, the amount of hands that they might play. So that's pretty obvious. Squeeze range is interesting. A squeeze play is generally when someone raises and someone else calls, and now it's your turn to act, and you believe in your heart that those hands, at least the hand in the middle, isn't strong enough to have accepted a raise or to battled against a raise. So you figure if they're not strong enough to raise on its own, then you can get it up by raising yourself. So you're literally squeezing that player out of the hand, and now all you're really doing is just raising the original raiser, hoping to get him out, because you know you're going to get the guy in the middle out. So squeeze range is...
That first guy worry about the next guy.
Yeah.
What he's going to raise, so that's how it ends up being very effective.
And that's what the range is, the hands that this person could be squeezing you with. And I don't think there really is a lot of ranges, because I think a lot of these squeeze plays happen when you have nothing. And if I remember correctly, one time I think I heard Barry Greenstein say that on one of these poker shows when he was playing. He was talking to somebody, and someone had said, yeah, that was a squeeze. And then Barry said something like, well, it's not a true squeeze because you had ace-king or something. A true squeeze is when you have absolutely nothing. That's what I thought he said once. I could be wrong.
Yeah, and I'm going to guess where squeeze range comes up in description afterwards is understanding the player who's making the squeeze, what could be the squeeze play.
Yeah.
What is his or her range for feeling comfortable doing that so you know whether you can play back or not.
Yeah.
You know, for example, if you're a nitty player, which means tight, like me, even if you see these spots, you may not execute the squeeze play as often as a more aggressive player would, right?
Yeah.
So when I do make it, then generally it's going to be a better hand than other people would. And that gets into that what you're talking about with Barry Greenside. It may not end up being a squeeze at that point because the hand is so good that it doesn't matter.
Right.
But I think, again, in terms of description of hands and trying to figure out your opponents, that's where squeeze range comes in. You know, is this a player that's capable of making a squeeze play with any two cards, or is this a player that's got to have something?
Right. On the surface, it looks like a squeeze, but really this is just a nit who woke up with a hand.
Right.
Is that how I feel? And if I feel his squeeze range is nothing, then I think he's got to have a good hand, and I'm going to lay it down. So, very good. Range balancing is adjusting your perceived ranges for a player based on his or her play. So you may, as you play longer with this person, realize, wow, I gave this guy a lot of credit for hands, but now I'm realizing now he's a crazy player and he's playing a lot of different hands, so I need to start to think that he's going to play more hands when he makes these kinds of plays and I can play back at him.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
Okay. The last one was calling range, and this is, of course, the range of hands a player might call with rather than raise or fold. So what are the hands that this guy, you know, what are the hands that this guy could call my raise with and not re-raise me and not fold with? So does he have Jack 10 suited and that's the type of hand he wants to go to battle with me or whatever? So basically pretty simple stuff.
Yeah, once you understand range, I think the rest of the stuff kind of falls into
into
place a little bit, or at least it makes it easier to decipher. Floating, again, this is probably not a drastically new term, but it means calling behind a player with the intention of betting or raising to take the pot away from them on a future betting round. Really common in Omaha. But you could do it in Hold'em as well, too. You know, you just don't believe, you know, rather than raising and being aggressive right now, we'll call and look weak and then spring to action on the next street.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you really believe in your heart somebody has ace-king and you have sevens pre-flop and Hold'em, and the flop comes 4-3-9 and they bet and you don't believe them, you call on the turn. Usually you're in position, obviously, when you float. You're not out of position, because that's what you have to float for. You have to call the bet and wait for them to check to you after that. So then on the flip turn, he checks. Now you bet and steal it away from him because you believed he had ace-king and didn't hit on the flop of the turn. Something like that, and that's how it's bet. So, laggy. Loose aggressive player, which is one who plays a wide range of players but bets, raises, and re-raises often with them. The other stuff he was talking about is like, why is there no taggy? Because there's a laggy. You know, I mean, there are tag. People say tag. I just don't remember hearing it in taggy. But yeah, there's probably taggy people. I just don't know. Sounds funny.
I guess the reason those other ones might not have taken off as much as laggy is just such the new way of playing, I guess.
Maybe, yeah.
And those players, the way they play, they just derive attention based on the play. I mean, if you're a tight, aggressive player, no one's really going to notice your play or comment on it too much. It's certainly not tight passive. But laggy are the type of people, when you walk away from the table when you're at dinner and a dinner break, you're like, oh my God, this guy's just crazy.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why that nickname's taken off, and the other ones haven't quite yet. But super aggro, as you mentioned. Again, aggro is just short for aggressive, and I hope everybody knows what aggressive means. So super aggro is just, I guess in my opinion, the most aggressive style play you'll encounter.
Yeah.
There's aggressive players and then there's super aggros.
There's positive EV, negative EV. Again, nothing new here, but EV is expected value. That's what it means. A mathematical term for the possibilities that a play or event will return the value. So positive EV means that you can expect to make money, and negative EV means you're not. How's that? Sounds good, right?
Yep. Polarizing, this means the actions that dictate exactly what the hand is, either great or terrible.
Yeah, so another one when they say to you, you might as well play your hand face up now, it's a very polarizing hand. You already know that the way you're playing this hand has to be aces, or has to be junk, or whatever it is. So polarizing just means either end of the spectrum. It means very, very strong, or very, very weak.
Very good.
Travel rake, this is a cool one that I actually first heard from Jonathan Little, too. I don't know if that's where you first heard it, but
yeah, it definitely was.
I think he talked about it on our show, and he says, you know, he likes to use this term. He says he factors in the travel costs of getting to a tournament series and then the actual entry fee of the tournament, and then he expects what he will make when he plays in tournaments. He's come all down all the numbers and everything and says, I expect from a tournament like this to make about $2,000. And so if he makes about $2,000, if travel costs and tournament entry fees and everything cost $2,000, the travel rate is too high for him to go into that event.
And it becomes negative EV.
It becomes negative EV, exactly. So, pretty good.
But Maury said, it's obviously cheaper to play a tournament in your backyard. You know, if you live in, let's say, Biloxi, you can go to the Beau Rivage Big Series. It's not going to cost you anything to get there versus flying to Monte Carlo. You have significant travel costs. That's travel rate.
Exactly.
All right, take the next one. Lines.
All right, lines.
We're not playing hockey here, are we?
No, he says weak or strong in parentheses. When people say lines, they mean the type of action that someone is taking, a strong line or a weak line. In other words, when I took a strong line with my hand, it means that I bet strong with it. So if we're playing No Limit Hold'em and the flop, and I have, say, ace-king, the flop comes king-3-6, and I bet pot, or the amount of the pot, that's a strong line to take when it comes to how you bet. So that's what lines mean to me, and what I'm thinking everyone else means. So, and a weak line means that you made the minimum bet, or something where you checked, or in other words, it's like slow playing and betting strong or betting fast. It's the same thing. The lines that you're taking when you bet.
Effective stacks. The actual amount of chips you can win from a player. For example, if two opponents in the hand have 100,000 in chips, but you only have 30,000, then the effective stacks are 30,000. Because that's all you can win from each, and that's all they can lose from you. Obviously, they can lose more from each other. So it's often used to describe the smallest stack at the table in the hand.
Yeah, exactly. Fold equity, not new, but always good to refresh. Essentially, having enough chips in your stack to make a player fold describes fold equity. Yeah, right?
Yep. Essentially, if you still have enough chips that you can... push all in on the river and it's too much for somebody to call, then you've got some equity where you can expect that they're going to fold. Again, when you make a raise, two things can happen. You can get called or your opponent can fold, or you can get raised. But if you don't have enough chips in your stack to make somebody fold, then you lose that arsenal, which is your equity.
Yeah, you have no one's going to fold for your bet because you don't have enough money to do any damage.
Got one chip left, and it's a small chip. No fallback.
Well, Doc Frank wrote in. He's our healthy bet columnist who hasn't written for us in a while, but he likes to send in stuff for us. Always thought provoking. He sent up a couple of terms we just want to mention here real quick. One of them was value owned. He says that I'm not really clear on what this means, but I think it has to do with somehow inducing your opponent to make a value bet on the river when you have a superior hand. When you win the showdown, you own the opponent, but I'm not really sure this is correct. Check it out for me, bros. So, from what I know...
We're his bro now. I'm so happy.
value-owned is kind of what he said. It's either you're the benefactor or someone who thought they had the best hand and kept value-betting, kind of like walking the dog, except you're the person walking the dog, letting them bet for you while you had the nuts. Or, and you keep calling them. Or the other way around, you think... that you have the best hand and you're just trying to walk the dog. Meanwhile, the other guy's just calling all along because he knows he has the best hand and he's letting you value bet for him, so you were value owned. So basically, it's just, it should be value PWNED.
Yeah, I imagine owned. It probably is. I mean, because again, this is a verbal term.
Yeah.
And then this is one of those, the kids that spelled own differently now, so.
Yeah.
Those video gamers. All right, well, he mentioned snow, and he says, I think I know what it means to snow when you play deuce to seven triple draw, or deuce to seven draw. It's when you have a crappy hand that can't win, but it's full of blockers like deuces. So you play it pat and bet it hard, hoping to force out others who need these cards, right? Can snow be used in other instances or other games? What other cards can you snow with? Just deuces seems like a pretty restrictive definition. He definitely got the snow right on the deuce to seven.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I think it's just a fancy word for bluff, but like all these other words, it has a little extra twist. It's like a lemon, icy with a lemon twist, right?
I guess.
It is a bluff, but it's also because, as he mentioned, you have these blockers, so it's a bluff that has better success at working because, you know, and particularly in this game, you know, if you have a lot of deuces, it's very unlikely that anybody else has the absolute nuts. So by betting it strong, they have to give you at least consider giving you credit for having the nuts. I think it's tougher to me, and maybe this maybe disagreed, to snow in this traditional sense in other games, because maybe Omaha because you got some blockers, but in Hold'em you rarely have blockers, and I think you kind of need a blocker for that lemon twist in the iced tea.
You know, the you're right, the word snow, like when I was a kid, my mom used to say don't snow me, which means don't lie to me. So obviously snow you could say I was snowing, and it could just be a bluff in any game. You could say that. It just seems to be tied to deuce to seven for some reason. I don't know the reason why that is, and I agree with you that it's sort of the blocker reason why you use the word snow rather than any other, you know, like you said, I don't know if there are very other games where you can do that, but I believe snowing is mostly tied to just deuce to seven, but it does mean to lie or to bluff. I mean, that's my mom used to say to me all the time when I was a kid, so. The last one is rap in Omaha, and then nuclear rap, or as Bush used to say, nuclear. So he says, you know, I want to know what a rap means. So a rap is like, what, a 12-out kind of thing, a straight draw, a 12-out?
Yeah, again, this is one of the confusing things about Omaha for new players is, you know, in Hold'em, you got the open ender is the best you got. Right?
Yeah.
You know, where you get eight outs because you can get them on either end of it. In Omaha, because you've got four cards in your hand, now you've got extra outs to get a straight depending on what you hold. So there's actually a really great way that I found in trying to explain this in a more coherent manner than I thought I could, called OmahaPlanet.com. And they have a great list of all the different kinds of the level of outs that you can have in Omaha. So I'll give you two on either spectrum. I mean, one would be the 12-out straight draw, which would be a wrap. And the example is if your hand is 7-9 Jack Queen, and the flop is Deuce 8-10. So you've got the two cards in the middle of your four cards for the straight. Remember, you still don't have a straight because you got to use two in your hand and two on the board.
Right.
But if any one of your of those cards that you have come, now you've got a straight.
Absolutely right.
Now, a nuclear, when it gets all the way up, you can actually have 20 outs for your straight.
It's almost half a deck.
In Omaha, absolutely.
It is half the deck, really, when you're playing Omaha with a bunch of people.
Exactly.
That's the rest of the deck.
And that's where it gets nuclear at that point, because it's just almost impossible to lose. And here's the example that they gave on OmahaPlanet.com. You have 10-9-6-5, and the flop is 8-7-deuce.
Yeah. So any one of your cards comes out plus additional cards on either end now make it 20 outs from 12. So pretty
super
massive.
Strong hand.
Yeah, and it's nuclear because it's high powered. You know, obviously that's what they mean. It's a very, very.
Yeah, anytime
powerful.
You got 20 outs, you're a favorite at that point.
You're nuclear.
Yeah.
So really, everyone, thanks for sending in all those terms, and we thought it was an interesting show. I thought it was a good idea to get these, you know, the Ante Up Nation updated, and of course there will be more stuff coming up the pipeline that we'll have to learn about soon, but. You know, we'll deal with that in another show.
You remember those good old days of online poker, Chris?
No.
Oh, okay.
I forgot.
It's been so long that we forgot.
I blocked it out.
Well, a long-time listener, Rich Santoro. Remember him?
Do remember him.
He has sent us in a hand of the week from Carbon Poker Online.
Ah.
Which I guess technically you can still play on. That's probably what he's doing. But,
okay.
And it's high limits here, so you got some tissues to plug up in those nose,
man,
from bleeding.
High limits.
Yeah, we're playing a dime quarter here.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. But you know, a dime quarter can get pretty expensive. He says he's been playing for about an hour, straightforward, super tight table, and this is no limit, by the way, too.
Okay.
Not giving any away any value in marginal hands, folding garbage, but calling down often with mid-strength hands, things like top pair, good kicker. Which, according to him, is TPGK. Or I had to think about there. I got to right through there, right? Or decent second pair. So bluffing is very difficult to pull off. Basically, you need to wait for a strong hand, hope for a good second best hand to pay me off. That's pretty much sums up online poker the way I remember it.
Yeah.
However, he says, this is not in the cards, pun intended. As I had my big pairs blow up in my face most of this session and the last session, aces cracked two out of the three times. Well, that's a bad beat, man.
Oh, man.
Get a beer.
Yeah.
King-King sees ace on the flop with post-flop action. Queen-Queen sees ace on the turn with action. Jack-Jack hits the set for the straight, gets there from all in. Oh, boy. Those are all very frustrating, as he says. Okay. So here's the hand we're talking about. Pre-flop action. We have King-King Cowboys in the cutoff. The under-the-gun player limps. Another player calls, and it folds to us with our King-King in the cutoff.
Well, I mean, you raise with him. I mean, what else? You know, it's pretty straightforward, I think. There's no reason to just call unless you've got a very strong suspicion that the person behind you is going to be crazy. And since he described his table as very straightforward, nitty people or whatever, I'm going to try to throw in as many terms as I can from the show. No,
it's like the quiz at the end of the book.
Exactly. Was the guy behind you ICM aware? Are you in a tournament? Oh, no, wait, it's a cash game, so you can't be ICM aware. All right, so I would raise. You know, online I used to make it bigger than I would. Yeah, I don't know. So we got two callers, you said, right?
The end of the gum and another caller, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, normally I'd make it about a buck to go with this. So with some two more limpers, maybe make it $2 to go.
Yeah, this is what's interesting is, you know, I haven't been playing a ton since the cruise, but when I have been playing, I've been taking Jonathan Little's advice from the cruise that this whole 3X thing is just not the right way to do it anymore. It's an outmoded raise now, and raising, you know, 2X, which is a min raise, or 2.5X, or something like that, gives you a lot more options. And I'm really seeing the genius in it. I really am. It's made me a better player, I think, because I'm seeing the action differently now. However, that being said, on online, I guess I didn't ask him about this on the cruise because we're not playing online now.
Right.
But I'm curious now next time I see him to ask him about it, because on online, I think that is much tougher to do, to pull off, because people just like to call a lot of stuff. I mean, we saw this on a recent show when we had the aces, and there's like
five, you know, callers,
seven all-ins or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So back in my online days, I think I'm right. I'm gonna raise this pretty big, knowing that I'm probably gonna get called, but hopefully just getting called by one player.
Yeah, would you constitute $2 8X big enough?
I think so.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Yeah, I mean, something ridiculous almost. I mean, here's the thing with these again, because again, you don't get a lot of respect online. So, you know, you get somebody to go all in with you with kings, you know, online. Dime quarter game. Again, I'm playing the stakes here rather than, I mean, it's a game much lower than I would normally play. I'm fine getting it all in pre-flop with somebody crazy, because I know online, more than half the time, probably 95% of the time, I've got this guy crushed.
Yeah.
And I'm willing, if he gets aces or he has some kind of naked ace and catches up, you know, that's the price of playing poker. But for the most part, I'm gonna get so much more value out of these kings by getting somebody all in pre-flop. So.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds good.
And there's very little fear of somebody not calling your 8X or whatever it is. You know, somebody's going to call it.
And if not, you took down a nice 85-cent pot or whatever, and you move on.
Yeah, and you did not lose with kings. So
that's right.
You may not have maximized value, but you did not lose with them. So, okay, well, a hero makes it 6X to go, and he's trying to buy the button to hopefully isolate the open limper. Again, I'm going to say online, I don't know if that's big enough.
Right.
It's certainly much bigger than you would normally raise with in a, well, I shouldn't say that. In a normal idle 1-2 no limit game, you're probably going to raise it to 10, right? So 5X, so it's a little bit more than that. But I think online, you got to amp it up.
So you made it 150?
150, I'm
guessing.
Okay. It doesn't say specifically, but 6X. So
yeah, okay.
6 times 25 would be 150, so. Working on my arithmetic here, my trusty calculator out here. All right, so it folds around to the limper who called, and the middle position player called. So we got rid of the button and the blinds, and we're going three-handed with 485 in the pot, and that flop is ace of hearts, eight of spades, four of spades, and it checks to us.
Well, obviously kings are ace magnets.
Mm-hmm. Happens all the time. I don't even know why you play him. Yeah. I would fold preflop. I know I said that.
And I always bet these. I'm representing the ace I raise preflop. I'm saying I have ace-king, too. I could have ace-king. I could have ace-queen. I could have aces. So it looks suspicious to me to not bet now, which is fine, too, because then they might check you again on the turn because they're afraid, and then you bet again. But I feel like I need to bet to see if these guys are really slow playing an ace or not. And if they just call, then I'll make up my mind on the turn. Since I have position the rest of the hand, if they check to me again, I could check behind and then make maybe a small call on the river if they decide to bet out. And who knows, we could improve on the turn of the river too. So I always make a bet here. I'll bet like $2.
You know, I used to think playing kings with an ace on the flop was one of the more difficult things to play. But I'm beginning to think, particularly because we're in position now, that this is an example where we can set out our course for the rest of the hand based on our action right here. And we can go two different ways as long as we don't deviate from it unless there's some overwhelming change of information that makes us believe it.
Right.
I think you could do it one of two ways here. You can bet and represent the ace, as you mentioned, which I think is fine. If no one has an ace, they're probably going to fold now because you were the preflop aggressor, and an ace, they have to assume an ace is in your range. Your wide range. I mean, they will, you know, range balance after it when they see it.
Well, you never told us what the effective stacks were either, because I want to know what line to take. You know, because right now my hand is very polarizing. And are these players super aggro? Because I really don't think they are.
Oh, man.
Because somebody could be floating us, reverse floating us, that threw a new term out there.
Oh, man. Okay, so, you know, if you bet, again, you know, if no one has aces, they're going to fold. You might get raised by somebody that has an ace and thinks that you're full of it, at which point then, you know, you have to assess, again, based on their range, whether they're making a move on you or whether they really do have an ace. So a couple of good things come out of that. If you check behind, you know, on a first level, now you're showing, telling people, I don't have an ace, I'm weak, and somebody's could try to bet you off of it on the turn. At which point, if you're doing that, I would think you would want to, again, you're setting your story script for the rest of the hand, you're going to want to raise them to show, hey, I did have an ace, I was just slow playing, na-na-na-na-boo-boo, stick your head in doo-doo.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So if you check here, and then you fold to that bet on the turn, I think you're harming yourself long-term in this game, because you're showing people that, you know, fit or fold, if which we took off the show, right?
Yeah.
You know, if your hand doesn't fit, then you're going to fold, and that makes you easier to play against. So I think if you're going to check here, I think you're still going to be aggressive at some point, depending on what happens. If you're not comfortable doing that, then I would recommend betting here and representing the ace and playing it that way.
All right, so what do we do?
What do we do? What did our hero do?
No, what did he do? I know what I do. I already said I'd bet $2, so what did he do?
All right, so he says, I certainly don't have anyone ace-ace, as I would think the meaning of an open limp would be for check-raise preflop. I don't figure a big ace like ace-king or ace-queen because I believe they would raise preflop or bet out of the flop since there's a possible draw. They could be holding ace-x and looking to call down against action, or they're slow playing a set of ace or fours. I decide there's a good chance that they're holding suited Broadway cards or a middle pair, and I want to... I will fold to a raise or reassess on the turn if they call. So I bet $250, just over half the pot.
Yeah, okay, I bet $2, so that's fine. Let's see what happens.
The end of the gun calls, and the middle position folds. So now we're heads up with the person that just called.
Okay.
Pot is $8.35. The turn is the five of clubs. So our board now is ace of hearts, eight of spades, four of spades, five of clubs. Shouldn't change too much unless somebody was sticking around with a good old 6-7, right?
Yeah. So what happens? They check to us?
Let's see. Yes, our lone player does check to us.
I'll check behind. I don't think there's any reason to two-barrel bet here or three-barrel later because we can control the size of the pot. I'm not going to bet $5 now on kings when A's on board. So I'll just check behind.
Okay. Our hero says, I realize that my bet on the flop didn't tell me anything. I have no idea if he's drawing, calling to a showdown, or a bad ace, or slow playing a set. Oh, I think he might check raise that to shut out a semi bluff by me. I'm going to have to agree here. I mean, I'm certainly not criticizing the bet, because that's a very good line to take. But when you get called, you really don't know.
Right.
at this point. I mean, it could be any of these things he's talking about. He says this player hasn't been the type to call off with King, Queen, or King, Jack, especially with an ace on board and my continued aggression. So I guess that tells me that. But I could be behind or facing the draw, and I didn't have the confidence as to which one it might be, so I checked.
Yeah, I mean, the guy could have a suited ace. You know, any suited ace. He will limp all the time with suited aces. And then they see so much money out there after somebody raises behind them that they end up calling to hope to hit the flush draw. Could very well be looking at like an ace three of spades or, you know, something like that. It's an ace nine of heart diamonds or something.
All
so
right,
you never
so
know.
Let me ask you this then. If you think that is, I mean, again, obviously it's a range here. I'm not saying you're putting them on those hands, but you're putting a high possibility of them having a weak ace, correct?
It's possible, okay. Yeah.
I guess my problem with that is now I'm slowing down here. I think if they have a hand like that, I'm putting more pressure on them, letting them know, all right, so you got a little baby ace. I got a bigger, stronger ace. Just get out of my pocket. But by checking now, I mean, now the problem with checking for me in general is what do we do on the river? Because if he does have any kind of ace, he's going to feel emboldened now to bet into us. And then we're going to have to decide whether, you know, whether that bet is big enough or what we're going to do, assuming we don't improve on the river. I would rather take a shot at betting something here and continuing my aggression. And, you know, again, right now, there is a very strong reason for our opponents to think that we have a big ace. We raised pre-flop a pretty big amount. We bet on a flop with an ace, and now we're betting again on this turn card that doesn't change anything. You know, because I don't think it's very unlikely that we're going to catch up here and get a better hand. I mean, really, what are our outs now? Just a king?
Yeah. But let me ask you this. You said that we have taken the line that we have a big ace. So we're trying to bet somebody who has another ace off the hand. If they believed we had a big ace, they wouldn't have called our turn bet. They would have said, okay, I really believe this guy has an ace. And if they believed they had an ace pre-flop.
On the turn. On the flop, at this level, I think people do because they're hoping that they catch a two pair.
I think
absolutely believe that in my bones, that somebody with an ace tray here says, all right, he might have ace king, but if I catch a tray here, I'm gonna teach him a thing or two about poker and call. But we bet it now, then like, you know what, now I only got one more time to catch that. He definitely has it now, I'm going to get out.
Well, it sounds to me like from what he described, these players aren't imaginative, and we talk about all the time, we teach our poker 101, that people love aces, and they go with them to the end, no matter what. And that's what we always say, we always talk about that. There are a lot of people who, once they hit that ace, they can't let go of it. So this guy is thinking that you might have kings or queens, and that's why he's just calling and not betting the flop and not raising on the turn if you bet out. So I think that if he has any ace, he's not going anywhere, no matter what we do, unless we did something like a shove or
this
something.
This discussion would be easier if we knew the effective stack size. Just being funny here. I mean,
that's true.
Serious.
It's true.
If this player that we're playing against, you know, again, it depends on his chip stack. I mean, at this point, if I know I could hurt him on the river with a bet, he's probably less likely to call that third bet, that third barrel that we're talking about. If he's got tons of cash, then yeah, this is a very tough line for us to take because it's very likely we're going to get called. Or if he's short stack, he's probably just going to, well, I'll get it in and hope I'm lucky. And at that point, if it's really short, it doesn't really matter to us. But if it's in that sweet spot in the middle where we think we can hurt him with that last bet, then that changes things. But we don't know what we're up against here, so that would change my opinion.
My experience has always been that people won't let go of their aces. So after that first bet where I tried to bet them off on the flop and they called me, if they have an ace, I don't think they're going anywhere because they called. If they had a draw, then I should have bet. But it is hard for me to know. We're playing online, and I haven't been with these players a long time. So does he bet?
He decides to check because he doesn't have confidence.
Yeah, I don't really mind that check. I feel like if there's a small bet on the river, I call it. If there's a huge bet, I fold. There's an ace on board, and I have kings. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
You know, well,
I mean, it's definitely a good way of thinking about it.
Unless I want to rebluff.
Ah, very nice. All right, so we go to the river. The pot's still $8.35. The river brings the jack of clubs. So our final board is ace of hearts, eight of spades, four of spades, five of clubs, jack of clubs. Again, doesn't change much of anything. And our opponent checks to us again.
Yeah, that's great. That's fine. This pot's big enough. Check
so
behind.
So now we're going to be value betting light.
Right? Yeah, I don't want to value bet light.
Betting thin?
Or thin. You know, either one. This sounds right. I wouldn't do those, though. I'm just be happy with what we got. We have kings as an ace on board. Yeah, you might be able to force somebody off of the rag.
But this would be an example of what value betting thin would be.
Because, yeah.
You know, now our opponent checked the whole time, so it's not really showing us a lot. We got kings, so we think we're ahead, but obviously we could be way behind an ace. So if you're going to put a small value bet in here, this is doing it thin rather than having a set of jacks here.
And if somebody has like a set of eights, your opponent, then they flatted.
Ah, very nice.
On the flop.
Very nice.
So,
see, Rich had no idea he was being so educational sending this.
But really, I'm
just checking down and hoping our kings are good and that this guy was on a bluff of some sort.
Yeah.
Not a draw of some sort that didn't get there.
I don't want to be value-owned here. Because that's what would happen if I bet again. This guy has like the nuts. So let's just be happy that he checked behind and we controlled the size of the pot by checking on the turn as well. And we'll take down a nice little pot if our hand's good.
All right. Well, our hero says the jack looks like a big nothing, but I don't have his cards figured out enough to do anything, so I check behind.
Yeah, it sounds like exactly. Pretty much, I did exactly what Rich did throughout the whole hand. So sorry I didn't offer any help on this, Rich.
Our opponent turns over 9-9. And,
yeah.
Of course, we win. But Rich's question is, I feel like I missed two streets of value here. He seemed like he just wanted to show down. Maybe I can't keep betting into the ace on the board, but I'm seeing a trend in these super tight games where I'm losing big pots and my big pairs don't hold up, whereas I win the minimum when they do.
Well,
this is totally negative EV.
Yeah.
Look at that. He even wrote that.
Wow.
And it is showing in my results.
I disagree with that.
Yeah, I don't think you missed any value here. I mean, the nines, I am a little... And here, I think your opponent really misplayed this, you know. So he called pre-flop. At that point, I would assume he had to be set mining. He had to be deep enough to do that. I mean, could you put in a pretty big bet? Flop comes with an ace. He checks. And what did we do on the flop?
We bet, and he called.
You bet. So at that point, he's calling us only because he doesn't believe that we have the ace. And again, essentially almost as a float, right?
Yeah.
You would think now that he's going to have to come out and, at this point, be strong on the turn, turn it around on you and say, hey, I don't believe you have an ace. I do have an ace. I'm going to bet. There's no value at that point and not, of course, we checked it down. So at that point, it makes it easy. But on the river...
Well, that's where he gets scared again, then. He might have been setting it up to bet the river, and then the jack came, and now he's thinking, wow, an ace or a jack.
That's right.
Now he's scared.
That could be, yeah.
So I think that Rich really played it all right. You can't
think
like that, yeah.
Yeah, I think the other guy missed an opportunity to take this hand away from us.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough, though, because, again, if you had the ace and you bet and he calls, he can't take it away from you in the turn because we check behind. If he bets out the turn, how does he know we don't have an ace? We're going to re-raise him, so he can't do that with just nines. So on the river, he's hoping for an undercard to his nine again so he can bet. And then
that's
when
the only
way
he's
going to
win in this hand.
Yeah.
It's to bet on that turn and hope that we don't have an ace.
Yeah.
Or just hope it gets checked down and we're on air, which I don't think is likely, based that we raise pre-flop, or that we get lucky and hit a nine on the river. So at this point, I think if you're going to play the nines that way, make that call, those two calls, I think you got to put a bet in it. That's the only way you're going to win. If you're not willing to do that, then you shouldn't be playing nines for, you know, out of position for a race.
Yeah, you should have raised those nines pre-flop anyway.
Yeah.
And then he would have gotten his answer with the king re-raise and then whatever, so. But, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, good hand, though.
Appreciate it, Rich, and it's been a while since we sent you something, so we're going to send you a classic tournament dealer button from tournamentbutton.com, which offers a variety of home dealer buttons with timers built right into them. You can even customize them with your own phone. Ask about the Anti-Up logo version, and never forget to use code ANTIUP if you want free shipping.
All right. Once again, our hotline is 813. Just joking. I think we've given it enough today. Fun show. Thanks for asking us to do this show, guys. We really appreciate it and got a lot of information out there. So I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.